John Constantine, a Hellblazer podcast.
Hey everybody, and welcome back. Before we get into the episode, just want to let you know that this is the free version of the podcast, and all that means is that we are way behind where I'm at in Patreon. So if you are loving this podcast and you need more John Constantine in your life, definitely go check us out at patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks and sign up for the Hellblazer tier, where you'll get access to the entire Hellblazer library that I've recorded so far. And also, you get access to the exclusive episodes of the Planes, Trains, and Comic Books main podcast. So if any of that sounds good to you, definitely go over to patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks, all one word, and sign up there. And with that out of the way, let's get into the issue. Today we are reading Hellblazer number 60, and just a little catch up on what's been going on. The demon known as the First is after another demon that's a succubi named Chantinelli. And the reason he's after her is because he is on a quest to figure out a way to break the agreement that he made with John when John tricked him into curing his cancer. So Constantine made a fool of him, and he's not happy about that. So he knows that this demon succubi named Chantinelli is familiar with John. They're not friends necessarily, but they definitely have a relationship of some sort. So he tracked her down in hell, and she knew what he was going to do, so she ran away and was able to break through the dimensions into our world. And John eventually found her and then took her into hiding. And that is where we left off in issue 59. So first things first, with issue 60, we got the cover here. We see an angel and a demon embracing in midair, and their bodies are beginning to intertwine, so it looks like they're about to make love. And also on the cover, we see that this is written by Garth Ennis, with art by William Simpson, Mike Barreiro, and Kim DeMolder. And we start off on the first page inside of a pub, where John and Chantinelli are sitting and drinking and talking to one another. And John's narration is saying, "I do all my planning down in the pub these days. Planning bollocks. I don't have a plan. Didn't last time either. Last time." Then we cut to a flashback of the first time that John met Chantinelli. And his narration continues. "It was 1984, and Thatcher had the country by the short and curlies. Back then, I was almost living up to my image. Newcastle was a bad memory. The bog god was coming to the boil, and I had fingers in lots of pies. And then, 4 days before Christmas, came the knock at the door." And then we see John answering his door saying, "Yeah?" And then we see standing before him are a man and a woman, and the woman is obviously pregnant, and the man is saying, "John Constantine? My girlfriend is, pregnant. We need your help." And I don't believe we've seen this man before, but the woman looks very familiar. It is, in fact, Chantinelli. And she is all kinds of pregnant. And we see that this is part two of an arc called Guys and Dolls. And we see the name of this issue is Nativity Infernal. So like John said in the narration, this is 4 days before Christmas in 1984. So he sees this pregnant couple standing in front of him. And he jokes saying, "Herod's got the boys after you, has he?" And Chantinelli says, "Pardon?" And John replies, "Forget it. Right, what's the score here, sunshine? I'm not a doctor. What kind of help are you looking for?" And then the man and Chantinelli give nervous glances at each other and pause and don't really say anything. So John says, "Well, look, mate, it's nearly Christmas. I'm meant to be meeting my mates for a drink and..." But John is cut off by a bright light that blinds him for a second. And that white light has revealed an angel that was the man standing in front of John, along with the demon that is Chantinelli standing next to him. And John is intrigued, so he says, "Maybe you better come in after all." And then jokingly again, he says, "You can park your donkey around the back." Then we get a funny looking panel of the angel and the demon sitting on the couch, and John is sitting at his table smoking, and we get some narration that says, "His name was Tali. She was Chantinelli," which was a bit of a mouthful. And then John is saying to them, "So, how does an angel of the Lord get a demoness up the duff?" And Tali the angel says, And then Chantinelli cuts him off saying, "It's my fault. I was trying to be clever, that's all. No succubus has ever snared one of the hosts, but our sole task is seduction, and to me it seemed too good to miss. A coup like that, and my standing would be greatly advanced. So I found myself an angel, and I turned on the charm, showed a bit of leg, smiled the smile of glistening crimson, and it worked like a dream. My only mistake was to fall in love with him. He was perfect. I saw into his soul, innocent, stainless, something I could never be. How could I hurt him? And then Tali interjects, I watched her. She danced on Limbo Breeze, beyond beauty. I could no more resist her than she could cause me harm. And John cuts in, so you both did what you're supposed to do, whether you liked it or not. And Tali answers, I suppose so. Chantinelli set out to tempt me. And then Chantinelli says to Tali, and you turned lust into love. And then John breaks all this lovey-dovey talk by saying, and now she's got a bun in the oven, huh? Don't they have rubbers in heaven? And then John stands and says, I guess the rest of your mates aren't too happy about this, Ellie. They're after you both. This is like Guys and Dolls, only everyone has wings. And I believe right here he is referring to the play Guys and Dolls, which is set in the 20s, I believe, and it's kind of like a gangster story that's also a story about forbidden love. So as John stands and looks at him, his narration says, I didn't want to get involved. This was far too heavy for me, and I was getting ready to bung him out in the street. Sorry, kiddies, no room at the inn. And then Chantinelli says to John, you're right, we're in danger. You're the only one that can help us, John. And then John's narration says, she knew how to appeal to me, all right. Shit, it was her job. You want Johnny Constantine on your side? Well, flattery will get you everywhere. And then John asks her, why me? But instead of her answering, we actually get some narration from John, and we see that we cut to a panel where Chaz is driving John in his taxi, and in the backseat, we see that Tali the Angel and Chantinelli the Demon are with them. So John's narration kind of answers his question of why him, saying, because nobody else would have gone near them. The Phantom Stranger would say they were near disrupting the Cosmic What's-It and grass them up to their bosses. The Baron would laugh in their faces. Dr. Fate would try to cut their heads off. There's only one bloke who doesn't play favorites, who does this stuff because it's a laugh, who doesn't give a shit that curiosity killed the cat and wanted to see what you got when you crossed an angel with a demon. Guess who? And then we see Chaz is yelling at John saying, another lift? Another bloody lift? And John is telling him, relax, Chaz. And then the taxi pulls up to a house and John asks, are you sure this place is okay? And Chaz answers, yeah, Joe Hollis kicked the squatters out last week. You got your key? And then John holds up a crowbar showing it to Chaz and they kind of give each other a smile. And then we get a close-up of the angel and the demon in the backseat seeing John give like an evil-ish type of smile. And John's narration continues over these panels, giving us a little more insight into his motives behind helping the demon and the angel. And it says, and besides, if I help them, they could help me. Spies. One in heaven and one in hell. Then we cut to the inside of the house after they've been dropped off and Chaz has left. And we see that John is drawing a bunch of different sigils and symbols and pentagrams and stuff on all the doors and the floors of this house. They've also secured the windows by putting a sheet over them so no one can see inside. And they're only using candles for light as to not let anybody know that they're there. And Tali the Angel is saying, will these protect us? Referring to all the symbols that John is writing. And John says, nah, they hide you. Anything from hell will just pass by you. Don't step outside the lines. And then John goes to leave the building for a second as he goes to say goodbye to Chaz. And he says as he leaves, and if she drops the Sprog, John's a nice name, isn't it? And then he closes the door and walks out to Chaz. And when Chaz sees John approaching, he asks, who are they? And John answers, Romeo and Juliet on acid. To the pub, my son. So John leaves the angel and the demon to go to the pub with Chaz and think about all this. And his narration says, all I needed now was a plan and to know exactly what I was up against. The second bit was easy. I went to hell. And John is talking metaphorically because he doesn't actually go to hell. Apparently, we skipped the whole pub thing where he got this idea and we cut to him in front of the gates of Whitechapel Hospital for the Criminally Insane. And we see that John is let in by a doctor who apparently knows John because she is saying, you are becoming quite a pain, Constantine. You cannot expect to come around here and harass my patients. And John says, yes, I can, Dr. Hindley. As long as I've got copies of your patient files, I can do whatever the frig I want. Some GPU or still prescribing thalidomide 2 years after they pulled the plug. And the doctor looks kind of angry at him and says, it was an honest mistake. And John answers, tell that to the judge. Where's Clive? And what John was talking about with the doctor is something called thalidomide was a morning sickness drug that was deemed the wonder drug. And I can't remember what year it happened. I think it was in the 60s or 70s. But basically, this wonder drug did not do only what it was prescribed to do. The women who were taking it ended up giving birth to babies that had extreme deformities. The most notable and, I guess, common was the baby being born without arms, and the hands would be attached directly to, I guess, the shoulders. And I believe that this only happened in Britain, and luckily did not make it anywhere near the USA. So you can see why the doctor would not want that information getting out. So we cut to the cell, I guess, or the room of a man named Clive. And John's narration says, "Clive was where he always was." And we see Clive and John are sitting at a table across from one another. And Clive asks, "May I have a cigarette?" And as John lights one of his cigarettes, he says, "Not unless you want me to stub it out on your bollocks." Then we get a close-up of Clive, and he's kind of a balding man. He looks very thin and gaunt, but he definitely has an evil-ish looking face. And the narration of John says, "Over the summer of 1981, Clive Peters raped and killed 5 kids from a local housing estate. He had help from the shit demon he called up, but all it did was add resolution to his inclination. Being in a room with him was like drinking piss." So Clive pauses at the slight John said to him, and then he says, "How can I help you?" And John answers, "By sodding off. I want to talk to Gout." And then we see the face of Clive change to look even more creepy and evil, and he begins to drool as he says, "Your pleasure, huh?" And John looks disgusted as this transformation happens, but he continues saying, "You bet. This fine romance must be stirring things up good and proper down where you are, Gout. Who's on the case?" And Gout answers, "Romance? Not like you. Waste time. Talk shit, Willie. Romance." And then John's narration says, "And that was where it all began to go pear-shaped." And John, not believing Gout, asks, "Are you taking the piss or what?" And then Gout stands up and leans across the table and says, "Still not see. Who's romancing? What stirred up? Inferno calm. No one on case. No case." And then John stands up too in response and points at him saying, "Don't push it, you little turd. The tempter girl and the..." But then John stops himself as he realizes something, and his narration says, "I was so wound up, I nearly told the bastard." And then John puts out his cigarette on the table in front of Gout and says, "Ah, sod it. You can piss off, Gout. I won't be needing you again. Got someone new." And Gout tries to answer saying, "Still not. Oh. And then Gout leaves Clive's body and Clive returns. And John says to him, "It's okay, Clive. Here, I've changed my mind. Have one." And he hands out his cigarettes to Clive, and Clive takes one saying, "Gracious me, you're very kind. May I have a light?" And then John lights himself his own cigarette and says, "No." And then he leaves Clive's room. So John goes back to the house. They don't really show how he gets there. But as he's walking up to the house, he sees that the door is off its hinges. And John's narration says, "Marvelous thing, hindsight. It's like watching a movie you've seen before when some bloke's walking down a spooky tunnel or the teenagers are breaking into the haunted house. No, you Burks, don't go in. Run. Can't you see? It's so freaking obvious." And once John sees the door, he runs towards it and his narration says, "But it wasn't. It just didn't make sense. Gout didn't know. Hell hadn't woken up. So who did that leave?" And as John is running into the house, he hears screams saying, "Ah! Ah!" And as he comes into the room that the angel Tali and Chantinelli, the demon, are in, he sees that she is giving birth. And Tali says to John, "She's going. It's her time, and I don't know what to do." And as John walks in, he says, her what? Oh, shit." Then as Chantinelli's pushing, she looks over to Tali and says, You bastard, you put this thing in me and it's tearing me apart." And Tali reaches out trying to comfort her saying, "Chantinelli, no, I love you." And then Chantinelli takes her super sharp nails and she digs them into the flesh of his arm, like literally into the flesh of his arm. And she says, "Bullshit." And as John watches this, his narration says, "That miracle of birth crap, that's the way men talk about it. Cheryl once told me it's like shitting a football and I don't know what to do either. But someone else did." And then all of a sudden, one of the covered windows blows up and shatters into the room, and there's a very bright white light coming through it. And as John gawks at this window, his narration continues, "Someone who wouldn't allow this. Not hell. They don't know." And then as John goes up to the window, he looks out, and he sees 7 figures cloaked in white, and we don't see their faces, but we see their hands clasped in front of them like they're monks or something. And they all have a bright yellow aura surrounding them. And they don't say anything. They just look up at Tali. And as Tali sees them, all of a sudden, he is engulfed in flames. And we see a fiery sword stabbing him in the face. And then in front of Chantinelli, as she's giving birth, his body is eaten up entirely by the flames. and she yells out, "Tally!" But then her contractions start again, and she has to focus on that. So the people in the white robes go into the room, and John huddles in a corner as they surround Chantinelli as she's giving birth, not doing anything. They're just letting her give birth on her own. And John's narration says, "In the end, she went through it alone. They watched. All of them. The Angel of Mercy, too. They watched." So if you hadn't guessed, these cloaked figures are other angels, I guess, different angels, one of them being the Angel of Mercy, but that is the only one that they name. So John is sitting in the corner and he's holding his head in his hands and he's sweating profusely, and the narration continues. "I've heard things. I've heard the banshee, a burning seraph's howl, hell's teeth crunching shut on an innocent soul. I've had the devil hissing in my ear, but that was the birth scream of something that wasn't meant to be. That's the one scarred across my soul. Whatever it was, they took it away. I prayed to God they killed it, but I hope it's still alive." Then we get a panel of the room in shambles as Chantinelli lays on the couch after her birth. And she looks to be passed out, or at least resting after that traumatic experience. And there's a sheet covering her body, and the whole lower half of it is soaked in blood. And John is just sitting there rubbing his head like he's got a really bad migraine or something. It seems like the angels were able to do something to John's mind to make him run away in fear and stay there while this whole ceremony was going on. And when they left, it's kind of like he's coming off a drug or something. Then we cut back all the way to the bar. If you remember, that's where John and Chantinelli were talking and where we recounted this whole experience. So they stand up to leave, and John's narration says, "A lot of water under the bridge since then. Thatcher's whelp is in charge of us now, but he still spreads his cheeks for the Yanks. The 80s died. I beat the devil. Ellie made it home and no one had missed her. With the masking signals I'd drawn in the pentacle, she got off scot-free. That's the one she owes me for. Makes me feel like shit, but what can you do?" And one thing that's interesting is as Chantinelli is walking out, every man that she passes looks at her. And it's not just because they're creepy guys, I think. It's because she is a succubus, and she just has this aura that attracts men, or possibly all people, to her. So as they walk out of the bar, Chantinelli says, "John, if you get the devil off my back, what then? What are you going to want to do to me?" And then she gets closer to him and kind of starts to flirt with him. And she says, "Or rather, what would you like to try?" And John doesn't fall for it. He just kind of looks at her and laughs and says, "Well, well. You must be really desperate to try shit like that with me, love." And then they walk away into the night, and as they do, John's narration says, "God knows what she'd try if she knew what I was thinking. There's this idea I've got. One of those mad little ones that stew in your head and dare you to try them. There's a war coming, me and him. It's a long way off, might not be for years, but it's coming, and I have to be ready." Then we cut to hell, and we see the first is leaning against the railing of a hellish-looking balcony. And by that, I mean there's like bones and skulls and spikes and stuff on this railing. And he's saying to someone we can't see, "How does it feel? Any thoughts?" And then the first says a quote back to the person he's talking to, saying, "I don't care what he says. He may strut through hell like a painted king. He may swear vengeance till he's blue in the face. But Constantine will be near Gaul's prize." And then he says sarcastically to the person he's talking to, "Walls have ears, literally. This is my hell now. I don't get bored. I don't forget. I know what happens here, and that's my power. So tell me, Nergal, how does it feel to be mortal again?" Then we cut to the person he's talking to, and we see it is a young man who is hanging by a noose from his neck, and his right forearm is torn off, leaving the upper half of his arm a bloody stump. So if you didn't catch what the first said, this human that is here is actually the original form, the human form, of the demon Nergal. And we know the demon Nergal from the very beginning issues of Hellblazer. He was one of John's earliest foes, and he was possibly the first demon we've seen John trick and kind of mess with. But the first has depowered him here in this situation by turning him human. So the first continues to talk to Nergal, saying, "You were such a keen little crimson mind when you first came here. They burnt you as a witch's boy, didn't they? When they found out how you played with their children? It took you 10,000 years to become a demon, Nergal. I reversed that in an instant. So don't despair. You'll be able to start all over again." And then we get a close-up of the human Nergal's face, looking extra anguished through the pain as he hears the first say that to him. And then the first stands up and begins to walk down the stairs of this castle that he's in. And the narration says, but all his pleasures are hollow these days. There's a memory that tortures him and turns the good times bad. Of a tormentor who laughs in his face, pisses in his pride. And then the first stares into some kind of cloud of blackness that's swirling in front of him, and he says, "You are my enemy, Constantine, my adversary, my devil." And we see an image appear behind him, and it's just like in his mind, I'm assuming, but it's a great panel of John giving him the finger and kind of smiling smugly. And that is the end of the issue. So if you guys have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email me at planes, trains, and comic books, all one word, at gmail.com. And we will see you on the next one.